This is Samuel's Persiflage, episode number 4 for April 2006. Welcome to Samuel's Persiflage. I'm back. It's been a while, but I'm back, and it's good to be back because, of course, we did miss the March edition. There were a few hiccups with interview schedules, and, well, it just turned out that we couldn't really get anyone on for that episode. No one was available, so it's good to be back, though, and we've got plenty to go through. Well, we've got the gentleman of Australian Airwaves. John Kerr is on with us a little bit later on. Here we're talking not about Australian radio, but about UK radio, or more specifically, pirate radio in the UK, which he was involved in many years ago. He still has fond memories of that, so we'll be chatting with John about that a little bit later on. We've got plenty of feedback to go through. Plenty of feedback. A lot of you have been asking to know a little bit more about Mrs. Sylvia Gordon-Stewart, who, of course, appeared in some photos back in December on the website around Christmas time. She appeared with Natty, of course. So she's going to be on the show. She's going to tell us a bit more about herself, which I'm sure will please quite a few of you who are listening. I know a lot of you have been asking me as the months have gone by for a bit more information. So she's more than happy to come in and tell us all about that. There's a few odd stories to go through as well. We'll get to them a little bit later on. But the thing I'm most excited about is we have a new feature. It's the Persiflage Puzzle. Now, the way it works is a bit like Hangman. It's also a bit like Wheel of Fortune, I suppose. What you probably need to do is get a piece of paper or open a text editor or something, because what I'm going to do, I'm going to give you a puzzle, a word puzzle. I'm going to tell you how many words there are and how many letters there are in each word. And then as we go through the show, I'm going to reveal some of the letters to you. I'm just going to pull them out of a hat at random, and when I do that, I'll reveal where they are in the puzzle. Now, I'm going to be a bit generous this time because, well, it's the first episode in a long time, and also because it's the first Persiflage puzzle, I'm going to give you 4 more letters than I usually would. So, next month, we will be having a few less letters, but I hope you've got the paper ready, because we have 4 words in this puzzle. The first word has 3 letters, the second word has 6 letters, the third word has 7 letters, and the last word has 6 letters. I should really learn to speak before I start announcing puzzles. The clue for this puzzle is that it is a title. Now, quite simply, because I'm feeling generous, I'll just give you some letters straight away. I'm going to give you 5 letters, so let's dig into that hat and see what we can pull out. Let's see, the first letter, we have an L. And let's see, the 5th letter in the 4th word is an L. So that's an L there. Let's have a look and see if we can find any V's in this puzzle. V for Victor. There are none of them. Afraid not. There are no V's in this puzzle. That's a V for Victor. None of them. Let's draw another letter out. We've got the letter I. I for igloo. And I can tell you that the 5th letter of the 3rd word is an I. So we'll dig out our fourth letter, and that is a J for Jerry. There are none of him. No J's for Jerry. And as we get the final letter for this go at the puzzle, it's a G for goat. And the seventh letter of the third word is a G. So that gives you a little bit of a start. It's still a fair way off, but have a think about it. We'll come back to it a little bit later on. There are no prizes involved, but it's certainly a bit of fun as we go through Samuel's persiflage. Many of us have been on boats from one time to another, and a lot of us have experienced seasickness while doing it. So imagine if you had to work on a boat all the time. One person who did that is a person who I would describe as the gentleman of radio. John Kerr joins me on the line. It's my great pleasure to have him. John, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's an equal pleasure, I can assure you, Samuel.
That's nice to know. So, you were working in Australia for a few years before you went overseas. What prompted you to go overseas?
Oh, just like most young people, they get a wanderlust at some stage in their life, and I'd been for 6 years in Canberra doing the breakfast program in the 60s. And Steve Liebman, who's been known, of course, on National 9 television for the last 20 or so years, and I were great mates, still are, we both decided that we were going to head off overseas. Canada was going to be the first port of call. Steve, through some connections that he had with the American ambassador, secured a job, actually, in a place called Edmonton in Canada, and so we were both very excited about going. He had a job, and I knew I'd probably get one as soon as we arrived. He, however, did some research and found out that it gets down to minus 30 degrees in Edmonton, and said to me, well, I'm not going anymore, and I said, well, blow you, I am, and I left him behind, and he went on to a television career. And I went and spent some time in Canada, then headed off to Scotland on the way home to visit a multitude of relatives and found out about this phenomenon of pirate radio that was all the go in Britain at that time, and thought I'd have a little bit of a look just to satisfy my curiosity. And they offered me a job because I'd been in radio at that stage for 8 years in Australia and was more experienced than anybody who was working the pirates. And they said, well, would you like to come and join us on the ship? And I thought, well, why not, just for a few weeks, could be a bit of fun, an adventure to talk about when you go home. However, I ended up working on Radio Scotland, sitting off the west and east coast at differing times of Scotland for 18 months.
All right. I actually have a little bit of audio from when you were at Radio Scotland just here. I'll just play it for you.
On 240 metres in the medium wave band, this is Radio Scotland.
The time is now exactly 6 o'clock. Good evening to you. Kerr's my name. Music's in the game. With you for another 15 minutes on the Monday All Systems Go show. And at 6 o'clock, tell you that you can go continental in Glasgow and enjoy an evening that is totally different. Visit the Deauville Sporting Club. With the disc jockey that would rather play a song with the past than one with no future. That I'm about to do with the Yardbirds.
Certainly a different era.
Yes, a different sound. I'd adopted a very fake-sounding, awful British accent, but I guess I was young and impressionable.
It seemed to work.
Yeah, I guess it worked at the time, yeah.
Hmm. So those little rhymes were obviously a fair bit of your show, I suppose.
The little disc jockey catchphrases. Mm. Disc jockey would rather play a song with the past than one with no future. Yeah, I guess those catchphrases were all the rage in Australian radio and, I suppose, American radio at the time, and totally unheard of in the United Kingdom because all they'd ever heard of was BBC radio. And, of course, the people on the BBC never use such vulgarities. So I suppose I stole quite a few of the expressions that were being used by some of the major disc jockeys in Australia and made up a couple of my own and used them, I suppose.
Yeah, well, that's fair enough. It still happens today.
It does, yes.
Mm. So just briefly, pirate radio was, I suppose the best way to say it, unlicensed radio.
It was. Commercial radio was illegal in Britain at that time, and a couple of enterprising fellows said that there's some money to be made here. We obviously can't operate on land because we'll be arrested. So let's put radio station lock, stock and barrel on a ship, put it 3 miles out off the coast, in other words, in international waters, where they can't touch us, and the phenomenon grew. It just became unbelievably popular and successful. I believe there are something like 13 or 14 pirate radio stations at one time off the coast of Britain. Radio Caroline was the biggest of them all, broadcasting into London and, you know, southern England, audience of upwards of 10 million people a day. I was on Radio Scotland, broadcasting into Glasgow and parts of northern and mid Scotland, and we had about a 2 to 3 million audience a day. And there was a big generator on the ship that gave us the power, and there was a big, from memory, I think a 50,000 watt transmitter which sent out a very strong signal which blanketed a huge part of Scotland and parts of northern England. And the disc jockey spent 2 weeks on board. You work for 14 days straight, generally doing two shifts a day on air. And then you would have 7 days off. When I say 7 days off, that's if you could get off the ship. Sometimes the weather was not working with you, and the tender which came out from land to pick you up and bring out provisions and records on a daily basis and take new staff on and take old staff off the ship sometimes couldn't come alongside because the weather was so rough. So the 14 days straight work, sometimes it stretched out to 15, 16, 17 days. They were the days that you really got very angry, because after 14 days bobbing around off the Scottish coast, all you wanted to do was really get off and get onto dry land for about 7 days.
Now, March 1967 would be a month you would remember very well, because it was the month Radio Scotland was fined for broadcasting inside territorial waters, and it had to be towed. What happened there?
Well, the government had been trying unsuccessfully for some time to get rid of us by fair means and foul, and they found that Radio Scotland was, in fact, sitting close to the Isle of Arran, which sits off Troon. There's a very famous golf course at Troon on the west coast of Scotland, and there's an island called the Isle of Arran off the coast, and we were certainly 3 miles off the mainland itself, but we were sitting a bit close to the Isle of Arran, which is British territory. And so they find us, and the owner, the man who owned the ship, Tommy Shields, a Glasgow or a Scottish millionaire, decided that we'd better move to go round to the East Coast, because we couldn't continue to be fined all the time. So they asked for volunteers. People stayed on board. She was on tow, because she was an old Irish lightship, didn't have an engine. It was a hulk. So I was towed part of the way up the west coast when really bad, bad weather hit. And she came back and dropped anchor off Belfast, off the Belfast Lock. And I rejoined the ship the day that she dropped anchor off Belfast. And we sat there for about 2 weeks, I think, in very lovely weather and broadcasting a terrific signal into Ireland, but not such a good signal into Scotland. And seeing that our name was Radio Scotland, that didn't seem to really make too much sense. So they said, well, we'll have another go to get round to the East Coast. It'll be a 3-day tow. How many of you want to volunteer to go with it? So there were 3 disc jockeys volunteered. I was one of them, 4 crew members, and the 3-day tow, it's a very long story, I'll condense it. The 3-day tow ended up being 10 days, during which we sheltered for a day and a night in Tobermory Bay from fearful weather. We sheltered in the Kyle of Loch Alsh, getting up towards the top of the west coast, northwestern coast of Scotland. And then at 3 a.m. on a Wednesday morning, we went round the northwestern coast of Scotland on tow, remember, in gale force 9 conditions, which is about as bad as it gets at sea, quite honestly. And all of us thought we were going to die that night, because genuinely thought we were going to die. I mean, it was just fearful conditions. We're on tow, being buffeted around dreadfully howling winds, mountainous seas, and going around the Pentland Firth, which is a pretty notorious stretch of water. Anyway, we did get around and started to come down the east coast, and blow me down, the weather turned against us and came up from the other direction. So we pulled in for 4 days and 4 nights to Lossiemouth, which is where the RAF base is, and we sat there for 4 days and 4 nights sheltering from just fearful weather. And eventually, after 10 days, it was supposed to be a three-day tow, remember, ended up off Methil, Pittenweem, Anstruther, which is basically really off Edinburgh. And we sat there, I think, for the remaining 8 months of, I think it was something like 8 months of the remaining time on air before the British government in August of 1967 introduced the Marine Offences Bill, which meant that it was an offence for any British subject to work on the pirate ships. They still couldn't touch you when you were in international waters, but as a British subject, when you got back onto British soil, you could be arrested. So that didn't seem to be too much fun. So effectively, on the 14th of August, all of the pirate radio stations closed down and we all went our respective way home.
Right. And I suppose in some ways it's a very good thing that you did come home, because there's a lot of people who enjoy listening to you overnight on 2UE.
Well, it's nice of you to say, Samuel. Yes, we've had a very loyal audience for well over 11 years. I still remember those days on the Pirates, and we're looking forward to next year. It will be the 40th anniversary
Wow.
of the closure of the Pirate radio stations, August of next year, and I believe the BBC, of all people, are going to put on a pirate reunion to commemorate the 40th anniversary. They've asked for disc jockeys from around the world who were pirates to come back, and they're going to set up in the Thames estuary on an old fort, disused fort, a pirate radio station, and broadcast for a week, just as we all did 40 years ago. So I look forward very much to being a part of that.
It sounds like a lot of fun. John, thank you very much for coming on the show. I know you are very pressed for time, so thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you for asking, and nice to have your company, Samuel.
And I can assure you that a lot of my listeners will be listening to you.
You're listening to Samuel's Versifier.
Might have a look at some of the odd news stories that have been floating about in the last month. I've decided that this month we'll split it into two segments, so we'll have a look at some more later on, but right now we'll start off with some of those stories of dumb criminals. This one is from ABC News in the US. Investigators say four teenagers charged in a string of break-ins at the same Martinsburg home were so comfortable there that they ordered pizza. And on at least one occasion, three of the suspects allegedly spent the night at the vacant home, which was under renovation. Now, I mean, maybe they were desperate for housing, I don't know, but I can understand them wanting accommodation, but ordering in pizza... That was pushing their luck a little bit too far. And, well, maybe, I mean, you have a look at this one from Fort Worth in Texas. Fort Worth police were not amused by a handwritten message left behind by burglars who broke into a linens and things store overnight in the southwest section of town. According to police, the thieves left the message reading, "Happy B-Day from your friendly rooftop boogler," before they escaped the business. The note sat next to a stale birthday cake, police said. They obviously got away, but was the message deliberately spelt bad, or is that their level of literacy? Well, we'll have a look at some more of them a little bit later on, but I think we'll have another go at the persiflage puzzle. And I'll give you four letters this time round. Four letters. So let's start by drawing out the letter U for unicycle. And I'm afraid there aren't any of those at all. We'll move along quickly to the next one, which is the letter N for neighbour. And we have the fourth letter in the second word, that's an N, as is the fourth and sixth letters in the third word. Those are both N's as well. Let's have a look at the next letter. What have we got? We've got a H for Harry. And that's the fourth letter of the, sorry, the first letter of the fourth word. And the second letter of the first word, they're both H's. And we'll have a look at the letter K for kite. There are none of them. No K's for kite. So, well, it's starting to form. We might be able to work out what that last letter is. Second last word is now. Maybe. We'll leave it at that. We'll come back to that a little bit later on.
Samuel's personal hours is the feedback. Send your emails to podcast@samuelgordonstewart.com.
Yes, indeed, it's time for the feedback. podcast@samuelgordonstewart.com is the email address, as I'm sure you're well aware by now. But in case you're not, that's the email address. It's quite interesting to see what people do send me from time to time. I always enjoy looking through the feedback. But just a quick note, when you do send some feedback, if you're a bit picky about the way you want your name read, maybe you don't want your name read, could you please let me know? Because otherwise I receive your email, I don't really know how to respond to it. So if I don't know, I'm just going to use your first name, but otherwise it'll be what you request within reason. Pete writes, "Hey Samuel, just listen to your third podcast. They just get better and better. Who are the people that do the voiceovers? They sound great." Well, I'm sure they'll be pleased to know that, Pete. Of course, it's ausvoice.com, ausvoice.com. They're the wonderful people who provide our voiceovers, actually. They do a fantastic job, and I'm glad they did, because I really like them, and I'm glad you do too. I'm sure they appreciate the feedback as well. Pete goes on to say, "I'd love to hear your opinion on the national ID cards that have been suggested. Being such a controversial subject, I think it would make a great segment. Anyways, best of luck with your blog. I check it every day." Well, thank you very much, Pete. It's appreciated. The national ID cards, well, that's a topic that comes up every now and then here in Australia, every now and then. And it's an interesting one. There's always a different spin on it, on how it would be implemented. But personally, I don't have a problem with it. I mean, most people have ID of some sort on them anyway at any given time. And generally, people have a Medicare card, which, as far as I'm concerned, that would be the best way to implement a national ID card, is that everyone has their own Medicare card. It becomes a photo ID card, and it would be your Medicare card, and it would work as a few other things as well. I wouldn't be surprised if some of the state and territory governments oppose that idea, because that would mean they would get limited revenue out of, I suppose, their proof of age cards or things like that. But ultimately, it would solve a lot of problems, in my view. The national ID card is probably a good idea, I think. It's just a matter of how good a forgery can people come up with, and how can we best counter that? So, obviously, the technicalities need to be worked on, but overall, I think it's a pretty good idea. John B1B5 sends us some audio feedback. Let's have a listen.
Hello, Samuel. It's John B1B5 here. My piece of feedback on your personage number 3 is very well done. I particularly like the interview with Danny O'Brien from EFF.org. I found that very interesting. So, to use an old cliche, keep up the good work, and I look forward to listening to Persiflage number 4. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much for that, John. Much appreciated, I must say. Well, it's very nice of you. And if you'd like to send some audio feedback, you can. podcast@samuelgordonstewart.com is the email address. Wave format, as John did, MP3 or even Og Vorbis, whatever you want, send it through and I might be able to use it. I can't guarantee that I'll use all the feedback. I don't use all of it. I receive far too much to use all of it. But, you know, I'll keep it in mind, and it's just as valid as all the written feedback, so if you want to send through some audio feedback, that is, of course, most welcome as well. Andrew sends through this email. I quite liked one of the songs you used in between the sections. It's the one that starts at 38:52. In the last podcast. Any idea where I can get the full song? Well, Andrew, most of the music you hear in between segments is from the Impact Music Library. It's a royalty-free music service. You buy out a bunch of songs. I believe I sent through a link to you to their store. They tend to have these CDs filled with their music. They sell it to you. They give you a license to use it, royalty-free, with a couple terms and conditions. You know, you can't just go and play the whole thing and just redistribute it like that. You can't just do that. But, yeah, I find it's very high quality. I'm certainly enjoying using it, and I'm glad you liked it. In fact, because you like that particular one so much, I might play just a little bit of that one again, because I like it too. It is good, isn't it? Yes. Alright, well, John, this is a different John, sends through this email. Listening to episode 3 now, these security issues are fascinating, aren't they? And internet companies in China are the wave of the future. No one can hold them back. I predict Google will be owned by the Chinese fancy, an Australian website owned by Chinese people. Well, Google isn't actually an Australian website, John. It's actually an American website. John also says, what we need to hear is a conversation with John Laws. That's an interesting idea, although he tends to be a busy man. I don't know how easy that would be to do. It could be a bit tricky, but thank you for the email anyway, John. James sends through an email. Hi, Samuel. Loved Persiflage 3. Each episode keeps getting better. I liked Chuck's song, It's Just Not Normal, and it was good to hear John Kerr's voice. Well, I thought so too, but it was even better to have him on again this episode. I was intrigued by the story from New Scientist about rogue elephants. I saw a photo on the National Geographic channel recently explaining why elephants seem to go berserk for no reason. He's then gone on to quote from National Geographic, I presume. Bull elephants annually cycle between a state of heightened aggressiveness called must and non-must. A must elephant is primed to mate and fights other bull elephants, attacks other animals, and may destroy inanimate objects in its way. Mr. Bulls produce a distinctive low-frequency vocalization, the must rumble, and have thick secretions from their temporal glands between their eyes and ears. Legendary rogue elephants were probably must bulls, redirecting their aggression at random objects, including villagers and the people in the villages. Well, that certainly solves that mystery. James also sends through a picture of an elephant during must. It's quite an interesting photo. It's a little bit blurry, but thank you very much for that there, James. Much appreciated. That's pretty much the feedback for this month. If you'd like to send through some podcast at samuelgordonstewart.com is the email address. I look forward to hearing from you if you decide to send some through. Then, well, we might have another go at the persiflage puzzle, I think. So I'll draw out a few more letters. Three letters this time around. Let's start with the letter A for apple. And that's the fourth letter of the fourth word. Then what have we got next? It's an F for Fred, and I'm afraid there are none of them. So as we move along, we have a Y for yellow, which is the second and sixth letter of the second word. Well, it's starting to look a little bit more obvious now, but we'll leave it at that. We'll come back a little bit later on. We'll come back to the puzzle shortly. It's certainly shaping up there, and, well, you might already know what it is, but it is a title. And we will come back to that very shortly. There's a few more letters left in that one. But now, by popular request, or popular demand, depending on how you want to say it, is Mrs. Sylvia Gordon-Stewart. Now, ever since her photo appeared on my website, back at Christmas time with Natty, I've been receiving quite a few emails from people who want to know a bit more about Mrs. Gordon Stewart. So, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Well, I suppose what people want to know is a bit about you. They seem to be quite interested in you. So, perhaps we'll have a little look at the story of you. So you were born in 1954 in the town of Zwolle in Holland?
In Zwolle.
Zwolle.
Zwolle in Holland, yes.
Hmm.
That is correct.
Yes. So what sort of town is that?
Well, I can't exactly say how the town is, because I haven't been to that town much. I have been back to Holland. That's where I have come from, in the Netherlands. And in Europe, it's only a small town, so my mum has said to me in the past, and it's very Dutch, and you might have Indonesian people there too, Dutch Indonesian people living there, and it's also can be very cold in the winter time, my mum had told me in the past, and I have guessed that that will be true.
You went back to Holland at one stage, didn't you, for a holiday?
Yes, I did, and I had also got my own money organised for that because I was only still single as just a normal daughter to my mum, and I had decided to save up money to go back to Holland to see and visit my relations regarding my aunt and uncle and any cousins or any other relations that she has over there. And I did meet them eventually. And my mum, I wanted to go with my dad at first, but he had to work. So he gave my mum some money and paid for her travelling with the KLM, which is the Royal Dutch Airlines, which we travelled on, all the way to Holland from Melbourne. And, of course, it's a fairly long journey, so we had to sort of stop in between around towards Singapore first.
Because the planes obviously need to refuel and all of that.
Yes, that is correct. And then we were supposed to go over to Holland, to Amsterdam, which is the capital of Holland. But we didn't get straight over to there. We went over to Frankfurt, which is part of Germany. And we weren't thinking that we were going to go there, but we did. Some reason, I'm not exactly sure now what the reason was, but we ended up getting over there, we did something there, and then we went over to Holland, over to Amsterdam, where my relations and my mum's relations had expected us to,
Arrive.
Yes.
All right, well, maybe we'll go back to perhaps your parents. It's an interesting combination. Your mum was Indonesian and your dad was Dutch, is that correct?
Yes, my mum was Dutch Indonesian.
Okay.
And my dad was fully Dutch. He was born in Holland, but my mum, because she was in the Dutch Indonesian caste as that, she was born in Indonesia, but from Dutch parents, or it's the other way around. But anyway, but she did come from Indonesia in some way with the Dutch. And then she, of course, met my dad over there, and, well...
The rest is history, so they say. Yes.
Well, they met and they decided to, after a certain time, I'm not exactly sure when, but they did, they got married, engaged and married together, and then they had some children.
And it was a pretty large family, wasn't it?
Yes, it was, very large.
Although I suppose by the standards of those days, there were quite a few what we would now call large families, and I suppose back then it was more or less the norm to have large families.
Well, could say that, yes. I'm not exactly sure. Some people like having a long, large families, or, a few more children than just one child, and other people like just having one child, maybe two.
Yeah. It depends. Of course, the trend lately has gone to families with smaller amounts of children, so two or maybe one child seems to be fairly common, whereas previously it was quite common to see families of four or five or six or more children.
Yes, that's right.
Mm.
Well, I come from a family which my mum had really nine children, but one died early, and then she had their last eight children. In between that, another child died. That was between my older sister, Nell, who was the oldest, and then came another child. I can't remember his name, and he died. And then came my brother, Derek, then my brother, John, my brother, Hans, and myself came next. Plus then, 5 years later, my mum had another child, which was my sister Tina, up in Queensland, who is now in Queensland, and she's married too. I mean, all my brothers and sisters are married, except for one who was married and got divorced, but he is now living with my mum.
Hmm.
My dad's no longer living. He died a few years ago. Because of
old age, I suppose.
Well, you could say old age, but not exactly, not that far old. He just had a bad health, and he decided to smoke a lot, cigarettes and that.
That would have contributed to it.
And he had strokes, and that's how he died. He died in his sleep, nice and quietly. One day, one night, well, just Mum and I were with him, but we didn't know that he had died during the night.
Mm.
That was a few years ago now, so my mum is now just a widow, they class.
Yes. So one of your brothers, Hans, he ran away from home at one stage.
Yes, that's correct.
Hmm. So what happened there? Why did he run away?
Well, he had a misargument or something with my dad for some reason, and he didn't like the idea of staying with all of us at home. So he then eventually had packed his bags, and he just had said something to my dad or my dad to him, and he decided then to just disappear. And we hadn't heard from him for quite some time. Then eventually we wanted to know where he was. And we got to know a few years ago that he had gone over to New Zealand, and a country called New Zealand, not far from Australia, and he...
I would think most people would know where New Zealand is. Yeah.
Yes, well anyway, for some people that don't, that's where it is. It's up not near far from Australia. Anyway, he got married over there, and he had a bad health himself for some reason. Something happened, and he died.
Mm.
And he's no longer around.
No, but after he died, his family decided to make contact with your family.
His wife did, yes. Mm. Say what had happened, and I don't know the full story of that, but my mum knows more about it, and so does one of my sisters.
But I suppose it would have been a relief after all those decades of not knowing what had happened to finally know what had happened to him, where he had gone to, and how he sort of lived his life in a way.
Yes, that's correct. Because I was quite often thinking of him and wondering where he had gone to. Even my mum and dad did too, especially my mum. And she kept on saying it to me, you know, I'd love to know where my son Hans is. You know, I'd love to know that. Well, she got to know eventually. We all did. And we were relieved to know that he was still living and he hadn't, you know, did a suicide or anything like that type of thing.
No.
And so, but he finally died himself, with bad health.
Hmm. Yeah. Anyway, moving on from that, we might move on to, say, when you met Dad, that's my dad, your husband.
Yes.
So, let's not go that far just yet, because there's a little bit of history in the middle there. When you were about 4 and a half, you were still living in Holland.
That's correct, yeah? I was, yes.
You got epilepsy.
Yes, I got epilepsy, that is correct. That is a bad health, or partly health, and my health is not too bad at the moment now. But it was very bad at that stage.
So how did you get epilepsy?
Well, I was living in Holland, and my next-door neighbour was only a young girl, about around the same age as me at that time. She and I were playing game of ball at some stage in her garden or my garden, and we had played for a while one day, and I just said to her, I can't remember her name, she decided to ask me, you know, let's play a bit more. But I wanted to play a game of this ball, which we were playing, and she, I asked her, could we have a rest? So I hadn't played for a while, and she refused to let me have a rest. Then I said, well, I want to have a rest. And she just refused. So I got sat down. I sat down myself, and because of that, she got mad because she didn't want to keep on going. And I said no to her. I'd like to sit down, have a rest. Anyway, so she got mad, and somewhere in the garden, she picked up the stone, apparently, and threw it at me. And it hit the back of my head. I can't remember what side, but apparently it hit me badly, and I had to go to hospital and find out what had gone wrong. And since that day, my mum took me to hospital and found out that because of that stone getting thrown in the back of my head, I got an epilepsy.
Mm.
And that is bad.
Yes, yes. Of course, as it turns out, it affected parts of your memory, certain areas of the brain responsible for your memory were affected by it. as well as a few others. So that meant that it was difficult for you to continue schooling.
That's correct. That is correct. Right. Mm. Yes.
So you, how much of high school did you get through?
I only got through first year of high school completely. I had done that all through primary school, actually. And the first term, at the end of the first term in the second year, I was then asked by my mum and my principal, I guess, and teacher, to say that I had to leave school. I was no longer worthwhile me staying there, so it would not do any good for me.
So yeah, so you were struggling to, I suppose, keep up with the class and comprehend some of the things they had to learn.
That's correct, yes. Mm. That's why my mum said, well, we might as well take you out of school. Mm. And I said, well, I'd like to stay at school. But she said, no, it's better if you left. So at that stage, I was only about 13 or 14 years old.
Yep.
And I said to Mum, well, what am I going to do after that? So I got out of school, naturally, and she said, well, you'll be just at home with me, and if I go shopping, we'll come together. Mm. So that's what I've been doing with her for the rest of my life, up to today.
Yes. So obviously you were back in Australia by then, or you'd moved to Australia by then. Your father, he was an engineer, wasn't he?
He was, you could say an engineer, but he was also doing a lot of irrigation work. And that's dealing with working with pipes and that. Not exactly a plumber, but does work with dams, irrigation and sticking pipes in the ground and that.
I think when most people think of irrigation, they think of watering the garden, because when we talk about irrigation, we're often talking about the pipes in the garden for the water. Of course, that's not what he was doing. He was, I suppose it is still irrigation of a sort. It's just that it's on a much larger scale, and it I suppose overall it's a much more important form of work, because it's helping with our water supplies.
Yes, that's right. Mm. It was dealing with a lot of water supplies, and it wasn't just in Melbourne where we were living in rented houses all over the place, here and there, in different suburbs, quite a few of them actually. And he wasn't able to stay at home a lot, so Mum was by herself with us children, helping her and she helping us. And my dad did come home, you know, and stay home too, but at other stages he had to go to the countryside and do a lot of irrigation in there, especially in Victoria. And then also at one stage through his life, before he died, he went over towards New Guinea and did a lot of irrigation there. And when he went up there, after he had settled down, they said that we were able to come up to New Guinea ourselves. So we were living there for a while, the whole family. And it was a lot different to being in Australia and Victoria. Apart from that, we also lived in a town called Tongala, which was close to the border of Echuca and New South Wales, Victoria. And that's
So you're saying on the border of New South Wales and Victoria?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, I just wanted to clarify that, because we do have, not a huge number, but we do have a reasonable number of international listeners. A lot of them probably wouldn't know where Tongala or Echuca is. So it's on the border of New South Wales and Victoria, or thereabouts anyway.
Yes, it is. Echuca's in New South Wales, I'd say, or and Tongala's close to that.
Yeah, I've got a map right behind me here of Australia with lots of towns on it. So if I just go and have a little look, well, no, I can't see it straight off just by looking at it. So, do you want to just jump forward a couple years to how you met Dad? That is my dad, your husband.
After I came to Canberra, living with my sister first, because she was married, and she was living in Duntroon with her husband, Kevin. And I left my mum and dad in Victoria, and she said she wanted help with looking after her children.
Sorry to interrupt. I just found Echuca. It's on the Murray River. It's a bit north of the New South Wales Victoria border. But carry on.
And apart from that, I said yes, I don't mind coming up. So I helped my sister Nell and her husband Kevin looking after her three sons because they were only small, and she wanted someone to look after them. So I was living with them, and then when they got bigger or older, the children, boys, then she said, well, we're living in Canberra anyway, and so I did as well. But I then got a job, especially a job with Kamari, yes, thank you. Which is for epileptic people or people with
disabilities.
Disabilities, and I was working there with them for quite a few years, and helping out in the office part in a certain way. And one day I was living with these girls, in
it was a group house, wasn't it?
Yes, it was a group house, living with them in Canberra, and the girls had to split up one day. And that is, we all had to go our own ways to get out of the house and because of the rent. So we did this, but one of the girls, who I can't remember her name, she had her father down in Victoria, in Melbourne somewhere, and my dad, or I should say my husband, was down there, and she went for a holiday. And when she could come back, close to a Christmas time one day, she came back to me, and she said to me, oh, I met a man down there, and he's quite interested in you, thinking about you, coming to meet you. And I said, why, who's this man? I would not have a clue. And she said, well, this man is, I've told him all about you. I met him, and he's eager to find out and who you are and what you look like and all this. And I said, well, when's this going to happen? And she said to me, oh, this was in 85, and this was in November sometime. And anyway, I said, well, you sure about this? And she said, yes, that's correct. He's going to meet you next Friday. And I thought, well, all right then.
So it was a blind date. Neither of you knew each other. You just met by a friend.
Yes, by a friend of mine at that stage. And I said, well, what's the guy's name? And she said, his name is Perry. Perry Gordon Stewart. And I said, well, all right then, let me meet him. I don't mind meeting him. So I did. I got to meet him one day. And after
that's Natty. Well, of course, we've had this problem before. We've had Natty interrupt the show before, so We'll just take a quick break, and we'll let Nettie into the studio, because it sounds like she wants to come in. This is Samuel's Persiflage. Alright, well, we're back, and Nettie's in the studio now. She's getting pats from our studio guest, who is, of course, Mrs. Gordon Stewart. So, would you like to continue with the story?
Yes, I will. So, this man, Perry, came to meet one Friday night, around on about the... I can't remember the date, but anyway, he came to me and he said, "Well, let's go out for a dinner." And I said, "Oh, that sounds nice." And he said, "Okay." So we ended up having a good dinner somewhere. And then he said to me, "Oh, you know, I'm really eager to do something with you." And I said, "Well, what we intend to do." And he ended up getting me out for a few more times after that date. And from that date on, around about the 25th of, I think it was, or some date anyway, I've got it on a special...
Yes, we have a plaque downstairs.
Somewhere.
It's either in the dining room or the lounge room. I can't remember where now.
Dining room.
Dining room, yeah.
Anyway, and we got engaged, apparently. I didn't know that we were going to do this. And he said to me, "Yes, I want to get engaged to you. I like you really a lot, and I love you." And I said, "Oh, geez, you know, what's this all going on to?" And he says, "Well, you wait and see." So, anyway, apart from that date...
So to cut a long story short, you got engaged and then you got married.
Yes, a year later.
Yes, 1986.
86, in September, we got married. 6th of September. I think that's correct.
Sounds right.
Yeah. 6th of September, 1986, we got married. And then a year later, couldn't believe it, in June, we had our first child, and the only child I could have, and that is my son, Samuel.
He's sitting right here talking with you.
Yes, you could say that, yes.
Yes. Well, I'm sure that's... brought some of our listeners a bit more information about you. I know quite a few of them were very interested to get to know a bit more about you, and I'm sure that they now do. So thank you for doing that.
That's all right. That's fine.
Yes, and Nettie's in here as well. She's enjoying herself listening to us at the moment. Well, once again, thank you for doing that. You'll stay with us for a couple segments, I hope. And, well, we might as well get on to the next segment. Alright, well, I hope you've got your puzzle papers at the ready, because it's time to draw a few more letters out of the hat. And this time we're going to let Mrs. Gordon Stewart do that. So, would you like to pull the first letter out of the hat?
Yes, I'm pulling out the first letter of the hat, and the first letter would be Z.
Z, let's have a look. Well, there are no Z's in the puzzle, I'm afraid, so we'll scratch that one. We'll continue on to the second letter. Would you like to pull another letter out?
Yes, okay, well, I'll go and have another rouse about in there. Okay. Yes, the second letter would be an E.
an E. Well, that's looking like a pretty good letter, actually, because it is the third letter of the first word, the fifth letter of the second word, and also the second letter of the fourth word. Of course, this is a title, so I suppose those of you who live here in Australia would probably have a better chance of guessing this than some of you who aren't in Australia, but yeah, it's coming about. It should be fairly easy to work out what it is. We'll find out what it is a little bit later on. Then, well, it's time to have a look at a few more unusual news stories, and Natty's still in the studio, as is Mrs. Gordon Stewart, and Natty's currently on Mum's lap getting a pat there, so she's enjoying that by the looks of it. Well, let's start with this one. Neil Clark, the curator of paleontology at Glasgow University's Hunterian Museum, claims that he has solved the mystery of the Loch Ness Monster. You see, according to him, the Loch Ness Monster is in fact an elephant. Yes, it's an elephant. What do you think? Do you think it could be an elephant?
Yes, it might be an elephant. Mm. Yes, it might be an elephant.
Well, I suppose, though, you'd have to wonder how it would feed itself if it's an elephant. I mean, they seem to sleep most of the day, but according to Mr. Clark, most sightings occurred after 1933. All we have are eyewitness accounts, fuzzy photographs, distant video footage, and proven hoaxes. Most could be explained by floating logs or waves, but there were a number of unexplained sightings of a creature, elephant grey in colour, with a long neck and humped back, particularly from 1933. So he goes on to say that apparently elephants were allowed to, from nearby circuses, were allowed to swim in the loch, and people spotted the elephants, although it's a bit hard to work out what all the other sightings have been. Well, there's drivers following satellite navigation systems through a village called Crackpot have been directed along a track at the edge of a 100-foot cliff by their global positioning systems. Cars, minibuses and trucks have taken the steep, twisty road from Swaledale to Wensleydale in North Yorkshire. Of course, Wensleydale is famous for its cheese. When vehicles become stuck, drivers are reversing perilously close to the cliff edge, say worried locals. One of those locals is Carol Porter, who lives at Summer Lodge Farm, and she said, "We want this sorted out before something terrible happens. We're 3 miles off the main road and having to turn them back to tell them to take a different road. They're getting really frustrated." Of course, she was referring to the various drivers who keep going along the road, but you would kind of expect this activity in a town called Crackpot, wouldn't you?
Yes, possibly.
Mm.
Yes.
Of course, the people in charge of the global positioning system say that this isn't the case at all, that it's just locals making up the story. And I suppose with a lot of these odd stories, you do have to wonder if it is just being made up. And of course, there's another one. We all often say that we'd like more hours in the day. Well, here's an interesting way to do it. A chef who cooks in his sleep has begged doctors to cure him before he sets his house on fire. Rab Wood makes chips, omelets, and even spaghetti bolognese while sleepwalking. And while wife Eleanor reckons his food looks delicious, she can't sleep herself for fretting about what he might do next. He apparently gets up 4 or 5 times a week and mainly seems to head to the kitchen. He's been found making omelettes, setting the table, peeling potatoes and making chips. He's also been caught wandering about, putting the TV on very high and running the bath. Although the main thing he seems to do is cook. So, yeah, I mean, you have to wonder about that. If you could do something while you were sleeping, if you could just sort of sleepwalk around the house and do something, what would it be?
No, let me see. I have to think about that because I'm not sure.
Maybe you'd like to do the cleaning during the night, and then you wouldn't have to worry about it during the day.
No.
No?
I don't think so. No.
Well, it's probably not such a bad thing, because apparently this chef was caught trying to pour an entire carton of cereal and a carton of milk into a very small bowl, and he made a very, very large mess, although his wife does think it would be a good thing. His wife does think it would be a good thing if he could pick up the vacuum cleaner while he's sleeping. So those are pretty much the unusual news stories for this month. Mrs. Gordon Stewart, it's been a pleasure having you in the studio. Happy Easter to you. I'm sure our listeners will be very pleased that you've been on the show. I know I am. It's been great having you. Maybe we'll have you again some other time.
Thank you very much. I don't mind. And happy Easter to all of you too who's listening, as well as my son who's interviewed me. Thank you very much. And, of course, maybe in whatever time he wants me to come back.
Well, I suppose that depends on the listener demand. podcast@samuelgordonstewart.com is the email address. If you'd like to request that Mrs. Gordon Stewart come back, send me an email, and sometime in the future we'll see what we can do. Mrs. Gordon Stewart, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Well, the end of another month is upon us, but before we can go, I do have to tell you that the answer to the first persiflage puzzle, in case you haven't already worked it out, is the Sydney Morning Herald. It's, of course, the title of a newspaper, which obviously comes from Sydney. Well, I hope you enjoyed this month. Next month, we will have the National Library on. We do have that interview lined up, which is good, because I've been looking forward to talking to the National Library for a little while now, so it will be good to finally catch up with them. We'll go back to a slightly more useful amount of letters in the persiflage puzzle, so there'll be four less letters that I'll give you, which will certainly make that go a little bit quicker. Also be a bit more of a challenge, I suppose. And, of course, if you have some feedback for me, podcast@samuelgordonstewart.com is the email address. Some feedback, I'm happy to receive your audio feedback, much like John B1B5 did. Or anything else you might like to send me, podcast@samuelgordonstewart.com. Anyway, until next month, this has been episode number 4 for April 2006. I'm Samuel Gordon Stewart. Until next month. Ta-da!